This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
The Texas Playboys are on the air.
Now listen, everybody, from noon far, if you want. That's the unmistakable sound of Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. Our guest today, fiddle player Johnny Gimble, spent years playing with the band and is regarded by critics as one of the best to ever pick up a bow. Gimble began playing at a young age and joined the Playboys in 1949. He played fiddle and mandolin with Wills in the 50s, and he later became a highly regarded studio musician in Nashville, recording with Marty Robbins, Merle Haggard, Dolly Parton, Chet Atkins, and others. He toured with Willie Nelson and was in the house band for the TV show Hee Haw. At age 83, Johnny Gimble is still playing. He lives in Dripping Springs, Texas, and performs regularly in Austin, often with his son and granddaughter. He has a new album called Celebrating with Friends, in which he's joined by several musicians, including Willie Nelson, Vince Gill, and members of the band Asleep at the Wheel, including Ray Benson, who sings this Johnny Gimble tune called Under the X in Texas.
The X in Texas. Now I'm sitting here looking at a map I got laid out on my lap, and there ain't too many places I ain't been. But the one place I love best is spread out all over the West, and I'm trying to figure how to get back home again. But right now I wish I was sitting right under the X in Texas, right in the heart of where my heart must be. No matter where I roam, I never feel at home except in Texas. Right under the X in Texas is where it's best for me. Oh, Johnny Gimble.
And that was the song Under the X in Texas, sung by Ray Benson, written by our guest Johnny Gimble, and fiddled by Johnny Gimble, and it appears on his new CD called Johnny Gimble. Well, Johnny Gimble, welcome to Fresh Air. Thought we'd talk about your early days. You were born in Bascom, Texas, which is near Tyler. I'm wrong already.
I was born in Tyler.
Tyler, which is in East Texas, right?
Yeah.
What did your parents do? What was your life like at home?
My dad was a telegraph operator for the Cotton Belt Railroad. He worked 7 nights a week from 4 until midnight, no vacation. And my mother was raising 9 kids.
And how did you get into playing music?
I couldn't help it. My dad had 2 younger brothers that Uncle Paul played the fiddle. He had an old, sorry old box that he had sawn, play a bully of the town and the Blue Ridge Mountain Home and those old songs. And I think that was an inspiration. Then Uncle John, his dad's youngest brother, picked the mandolin some. And Dad bought a fiddle and a mandolin, which Bill started learning to play, and he started teaching me while Jack was teaching Gene, who's a year older than me. He's 85 this year. He said he's older than he ever has been. But Gene started learning guitar from Jack, and Bill is teaching me fiddle. And we wound up all of us playing together, and we listened every day on the radio to the Lightcrust Doughboys. It was a band that Bob Wills and Milton Brown formed in 1932. It was on the air until the 50s. And their opening announcer would say, "The Lightcrust Doughboys are on the air," and they'd thump the fiddle, ding dong. "Never do brag, never do boast, sing our song from coast to coast. We're the Lightcrust Doughboys from the Burris Mill." And when Bob started the Playboy band, he used that for a theme, which he helped write it with Milton, but he used it and changed it to "The Texas Playboys are on the air."
Do you remember the first time anybody paid you to play music, to perform?
Yes. In fact, there was a milling company at Denton, Texas, up near the Oklahoma border, that made a flour called Peacemaker Flour. And they had a promotion man, Big Boy Green, big old 300-pound guy that heard us brothers playing somewhere. And he hired us. He came by and hired us to go out on the Saturday morning early. He'd pick us up at 5:30 or 6 Saturday morning and drive to a East Texas town down to Lufkin or somewhere down that way. But he'd pull up in front of a grocery store, and they'd have a flatbed truck waiting, and he had speakers on top of this old 36 Ford that he drove, and an amplifier with a turntable where he could play records, and then we'd get up on the truck, and they'd put us through a mic, and we'd play music as the Peacemaker Boys, advertising his flour. So he paid us each $2 for the day's work. The only other income I had was we'd pick cotton in the summertime or the fall, whenever the cotton was ready. And my dad, he'd raised a few acres of cotton, and the going rate that cotton pickers got was 50 cents a hundred, like a half cent a pound. But he would pay us a penny a pound. He's paying us twice what he's paying the hired hands, you know. But it was all I could do to earn a dollar to pick 100 pounds of cotton in a day. I just wasn't good at it. So when Big Boy Green started paying us $2 for a day's playing music, which is what we really wanted to do anyway, it was a lot more fun than picking cotton.
So I know that you got together with your brothers and you started playing professionally. And I believe you hooked up with Bob Wills in 1949, right? How did that happen?
In 49, I was playing with a group in Corpus Christi, Texas. We had a daily radio show on KWBU, and we booked out and played dances in the surrounding territory. And Bob Wills was working from Sacramento, California then. And he'd go on the road playing one-nighters all across the Southwest. And they booked him in Corpus Christi, but they left us in there to open for him. So we played like an hour and a half. And Jesse Ashlock was the fiddle player in Bob's band then. And so Tiny Moore, who I had met 3 years earlier, Tiny doubled on fiddle. Jesse and Tiny would play harmony to Bob's lead. He heard us playing and heard me perform. And at intermission, we were visiting, and he said, "I think Jesse's leaving the band. Would you be interested in going to work with the Texas Playboys?"
I thought let's talk about Western Swing a little. And I thought we would hear a cut from your new album. And the track I thought we would listen to is Somewhere South of San Antone.
Right. That's one I wrote.
Right.
Back years and years ago, but it's a true story.
What's the story that inspired you to write this song?
It tells about how Barbara and I met neath the Texas moon above. And above rhymes with love, don't you know? I fell in love neath the Texas moon above, somewhere south. You can't sing when you're choked up, you know. I moved from Austin to Corpus Christi, and then we started going together, and she'd go to the dances. She loved to jitterbug. We married in January of 1949.
We should hear the song. Let's listen to this track from the new album by Johnny Gimble and many of his friends. This one, Somewhere South of San Antone, the vocal is done by Vince Gill.
I fell in love beneath the Texas moon above, somewhere south of San Antonio. Her smile was fair, a gardenia in her hair, somewhere south of San Antonio. Ah, Johnny,
many moons have passed, now we're going back at last. We're gonna make it our home.
Oh, she's at my side, for I made her my bride, somewhere south of San Antonio.
And that's the song Somewhere South of San Antonio from the new album by our guest Johnny Gimble. And the vocal there sung by Vince Gill and by you, Johnny Gimble. I mean, you sang quite a bit in your career and still have some voice left.
I sang a verse on it.
Uh-huh. Now, Bob Wills was known to enjoy a drink, and more than one on occasion. Did anybody have to look after Bob on the road?
The first year and a half I was on the Wills band, Bob was not drinking. He had just come off of a two-week case of flu, I guess they called it. And when he started drinking, I heard all those stories, you know, about things he did when he was drunk, and I never did see it. One time, we were playing in Phoenix, Arizona. We were on a tour of one-nighters through New Mexico and Arizona out going to California. And Bob, at intermission, one of his old buddies had a bottle. And when he came back on stage after intermission, he started mouthing off on the microphone, making an ass out of himself. And Eldon Shamblin, the guitar player, was the band manager, and he'd just sit over there and grumble. So I'd heard these stories about Bob being incapacitated for a week or 2 weeks at a time, and I didn't expect him to be on the bandstand the next night. But Eldon just got in the car with Bob and drove from Phoenix to the next date, and Bob was on the stand and worked the whole four-hour dance. So I asked Eldon after when we started back on the bus, I said, "How did you get him sober after that night in Phoenix?" And he said, "I got in the back seat and sat on top of him and said, 'Bob, the bar is closed. We've got a tour to play.'" And so when it came my turn to, we used to call it babysitting, when we were on a tour in 1951, he had a pint, and I put it between the mattresses on my bed. And when he wanted a drink, I said, "Bob, you can't have one. We got to play tonight. You got to work tonight and tomorrow night, and we've got to finish this tour." I saw that fifth of whiskey that had maybe half, three or four drinks out of it, you know. And it was on the sink in the bathroom. So I went in there and uncorked it and just poured it out, you know. And Bob saw me do it. He hated me forever after that.
You were known for putting an extra string on your fiddle, is that right?
Well, yeah, I was afraid you wasn't going to ask me, Dave.
Well, I know you have it there, and you got the fifth string on there, right? Yeah. What? Show us that fifth string, what it does. Yeah.
Okay. Here we go. And the low string. Sweet Georgia Brown.
You were just playing us a little bit of Sweet Georgia Brown. It sounded like jazz. I mean, do you think of swing as jazz? Were you a fan of jazz?
What is jazz? Well, it's getting away from the melody and playing whatever you're inspired to play. Like I tell about Jeff Brunner, the hottest fiddler in Texas. I asked him, they used to call it hokum. People disregarded it. All that, you play jazz, they say, that ain't music, that's just a bunch of hokum. And so I asked Cliff, when I was 17 years old, I got to play a show, he was there, and I said, "Cliff, how do you play that hokum?" And he says, "Can you hum it? Can you think it?" And I said, I go around humming it all the time. He said, well, practice on your instrument until you play what you can hum, what you think. You go through this, that chord progression, and you play whatever feels good. That's where that... I knew a fiddle player in Nashville, Shorty Lavender, says, oh, I can't play jazz. I can play some country swing. It's just country fiddle. You play it. It's like... Let's see. I learned the first tune I ever learned on the fiddle was called Darling Nellie Gray. You notice it. The first time Bob played Faded Love, it didn't have any words to it. He just played it instrumental. And I thought, well, he's playing Darling Nellie Gray. Wonder why he calls it Faded Love. And Bob's younger brother, Billy Jack Wills, was playing drums in the band. And he said, Bob, they all want to dance to Faded Love, but it doesn't have any words. He said, write some. And Billy Jack was not a songwriter, but he wrote, as I look at the letters that you wrote to me, it's you that I am thinking of. As I read the lines that to me were so sweet, I remember our faded love.
Well, you know, Johnny, I think we should hear it. We've got that. We've got the track here. This is Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys.
I look at the letters that you wrote to me. It's you that I am thinking of. As I read the lines that to me were so sweet, I remember our faded love. I miss you, darling.
And that was Faded Love with Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. Well, Johnny Gimble, you know, you started out picking cotton in East Texas with a big family and played with a lot of bands. We've mentioned Bob Wills, but a lot of other musicians over the years. You know, Willie Nelson, and we played studio sessions with a lot of famous folks and are still playing with your family near Austin, Texas. I know you live in Dripping Springs. What's been the best thing about your career? What will you remember?
That's a hard question. I guess all of it together has been great. I've had a good family. Dick, you know, plays guitar and bass and plays in our band, the Johnny Gimble and Texas Swing. And his daughter, Dick's daughter, Emily, was singing. We made a CD with featuring her singing.
Do you play every day? I mean, I know you perform a couple times a month, right?
But Chet Atkins used to have an expression. He said, if I don't pick that guitar up every day, it gets to where it don't know me. I keep a fiddle hooked up in the music. We've got a music room, and try to pick it up. And sometime I'll have a jam session with Pete Fountain. I'll have a CD of his I can play with.
The clarinet player, the jazz clarinetist, yeah. Well, Johnny Gimble, I want to wish you good health and great music. And I thought we should end with another song from the new album. What would you like to hear?
The Merle Haggard track, I take a solo on it, Sweet Georgia Brown, he sang. I think that represents my playing probably more than anything else on that CD.
Well, great. Let's hear it. Johnny Gimble, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you for all the fresh air you bring us.
All righty. And here is Johnny Gimble with Merle Haggard on from Johnny Gimble's new CD called Johnny Gimble.
Oh, here's Johnny.
Johnny Gimble's new CD is called Celebrating with Friends. You can hear three tracks from the album, including an appearance with Garrison Keillor on a Prairie Home Companion at nprmusic.com. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Jazz drummer Paul Motion recorded a classic series of performances at the Village Vanguard in 1961, playing quiet standards with pianist Bill Evans. These days, Motion still records at the Vanguard and plays slow ballads, but with some new wrinkles. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two recent Motion releases.
Paul Motion's tune, Birdsong. Jazz drummers leading their own bands tend to favor intricate rhythms and a brisk and driving momentum. Paul Motion, with his slow tempos, loose timing, and tunes that go with rainy days, is so self-effacing, he's almost an anti-drummer. A little rustle of brushes and the faint boom of a bass drum may be enough to nudge the music on. The odd thing is, Motion's trio album Lost in a Dream is sort of a triple salute to him, from the Village Vanguard, where it was made and where he's recorded for nearly five decades, from ECM Records, where he helped shape the label's own penchant for slow, loose, melancholy jazz, and from his younger side folk, Chris Potter on tenor sax and pianist Jason Moran. They get how to play Motion's music, make the melody sing, and keep the phrasing loose, but show up on time at crucial meeting points. Saxophonist Chris Potter catches the plaintive quality in the melodies, like he's listened to Motion favorite Joe Lovano. Pianist Jason Moran underplays his hand, resisting the temptation to fill up space in the absence of a bass player. Interpreting Motion's melodies, he knows less can be more. The album Lost in a Dream salutes the drummer as composer, too, reviving nice Motion tunes from previous albums to remind us he's never been much for slam-bam drum features. Even his rare solos take their time. Listening to the trio on Lost in a Dream sent me back to his weird previous album from later last year. The quintet on Paul Motion on Broadway, Volume 5, plays mostly standards, if not all show tunes. In that two-saxophone band, the phrasing is so ragged it's eerie, almost like they're rehearsing for the first time. It shouldn't work, but it does somehow. It's haunting like a ghost. Johnny Mercer's tune, Midnight Sun. Those lava flow saxophones aren't even the eeriest thing about Paul Motion on Broadway Volume 5. Many pianists sing along with their solos, no matter how much we wish they wouldn't. But longtime collaborator Masabumi Kikuchi's vocalizations are so unearthly, you may not realize right away those sounds are coming from your speakers, let alone a human mouth. The leader's drumming can be a little unnerving, too. Master percussionists often keep several beats or patterns going at once, but Paul Motion may trace a thin watercolor line of rhythm through the heart of a performance, as if he could only play his drums one at a time. It's all part of his quiet crusade against overplaying. There are flashier drummers around, for sure, but few do better at creating a mood.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed two recent Paul Motion CDs. You can hear a complete concert featuring Paul Motion with Bill Frisell and Joe Lovano at nprmusic.org. Coming up, coping with noise in the modern world. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Jazz drummer Paul Motion recorded a classic series of performances at the Village Vanguard in 1961. Playing quiet standards with pianist Bill Evans. These days, Motion still records at the Vanguard and plays slow ballads, but with some new wrinkles. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews two recent Motion releases.
Paul Motion's tune, Birdsong. Jazz drummers leading their own bands tend to favor intricate rhythms and a brisk and driving momentum. Paul Motion, with his slow tempos, loose timing, and tunes that go with rainy days, is so self-effacing, he's almost an anti-drummer. A little rustle of brushes and the faint boom of a bass drum may be enough to nudge the music on. The odd thing is, Motion's trio album, Lost in a Dream, is sort of a triple salute to him, from the Village Vanguard, where it was made and where he's recorded for nearly five decades, from ECM Records, where he helped shape the label's own penchant for slow, loose, melancholy jazz, and from his younger side folk, Chris Potter on tenor sax and pianist Jason Moran. They get how to play Motion's music, make the melody sing, and keep the phrasing loose, but show up on time at crucial meeting points. Saxophonist Chris Potter catches the plaintive quality in the melodies, like he's listened to Motion favorite Joe Lovano. Pianist Jason Moran underplays his hand, resisting the temptation to fill up space in the absence of a bass player. Interpreting Motion's melodies, he knows less can be more. The album, Lost in a Dream, salutes the drummer as composer, too, reviving nice motion tunes from previous albums to remind us he's never been much for slam-bam drum features. Even his rare solos take their time. Listening to the trio on Lost in a Dream sent me back to his weird previous album from later last year. The quintet on Paul Motion on Broadway, Volume 5, plays mostly standards, if not all show tunes. In that two-saxophone band, the phrasing is so ragged it's eerie, almost like they're rehearsing for the first time. It shouldn't work, but it does somehow. It's haunting like a ghost. Johnny Mercer's tune, Midnight Sun. Those lava flow saxophones aren't even the eeriest thing about Paul Motion on Broadway, Volume 5. Many pianists sing along with their solos, no matter how much we wish they wouldn't. But longtime collaborator Masabumi Kikuchi's vocalizations are so unearthly, you may not realize right away those sounds are coming from your speakers, let alone a human mouth. The leader's drumming can be a little unnerving, too. Master percussionists often keep several beats or patterns going at once, but Paul Motion may trace a thin watercolor line of rhythm through the heart of a performance, as if he could only play his drums one at a time. It's all part of his quiet crusade against overplaying. There are flashier drummers around, for sure, but few do better at creating a mood.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed two recent Paul Motion CDs. You can hear a complete concert featuring Paul Motion with Bill Frisell and Joe Lovano at nprmusic.org. Coming up, coping with noise in the modern world. This is Fresh Air. If you live or work in a city, you may have noticed and gotten sick of all the noise in our lives. Sirens, bus engines, jackhammers, booming music in the car next to us, and deafening racket in bars and restaurants. Not to mention all the people yelling on the street while we're trying to sleep or barking into their cell phones as if there's nobody else around. Our next guest, writer George Prochnik, says there's plenty of evidence that noise can be harmful as well as annoying, with studies pointing to hearing loss and even risks of higher blood pressure and cardiovascular problems. His new book is a study of noise in the modern world and an exploration of the benefits of silence. George Prochnik has written for the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and other publications. His new book is called In Pursuit of Silence, Listening for Meaning in a World of Noise. Well, George Prochnik, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, one of the interesting observations that you come across in looking into the physiology of hearing is that in the animal world, their auditory systems are designed to magnify very faint sounds to allow them to, you know, either avoid predators or find food, and that we, as, you know, more evolved species of the animal kingdoms, share some of that. And that's why when we're turning up our iPods or stereos, we're damaging our hearing because evolution has made our ears magnify that so much.
It's made our ears magnify sound a hundredfold from the source. So in the vast majority of cases, when we speak of hearing damage, what we're really talking about is damage to those amplifiers. We depended upon our hearing to navigate a very, very dangerous environment. And therefore, you wanted it to be as acute as possible. And there are not very many, as one evolutionary psychologist said to me, there are not really very many loud noises in nature. There's thunder. And then there are those brief periods of mating season when animals will vocalize intensely. But most of the time, you're trying to creep around quietly because you're either trying to kill something or not be killed. And we, I think, have completely reversed the equation from what the evolutionary setup was that established our hearing parameters, whereas we now have almost everything amplified as loud as possible in order to make ourselves heard in a very, very noisy world. And it simply isn't what the auditory apparatus evolved to cope with.
Well, one of the things you did as you were doing your research was to look into those who deliberately make noise. There are a lot of commercial reasons for people deliberately adding noise to our environment, and that was sort of an interesting part of it. I mean, for example, shopping. I mean, particularly shopping
right.
aimed at young people. What did you find?
Right. Well, I work not too far away from an Abercrombie and Fitch store, and I would hear the music booming out, and I would wonder what it was that was appealing to all the people enough that they would want to be in an environment spending a lot of time, which was often at truly eardrum shattering levels of volume. So what I really found as I began spending time in some of these loud stores and speaking with the people who designed the sound for them is that there was a very, very careful strategic effort to zero in on key emotions and on key triggers of excitement. And noise, even if we don't like to, even if we don't like to admit it, even if we don't like noise, is a very powerful, very brutal source of real energy. And in some of the loudest stores, like Abercrombie and Fitch, this is very obviously being exploited to create a sense of party, to create a sense of thrill and just in being in the space. What we know is that if you're loud at this point in our culture, it seems to signify that you're having a good time and it's a fun place to be. And this is the same phenomenon that we find in restaurants, which continue to get louder in many cities every year. And many people find this unbearable, but many people feel that a restaurant is dead unless it has that noise level.
Is there scientific evidence about the effects of noise or sound or music on food and alcohol consumption?
Well, there is, and it's not completely, I think, what all restaurateurs want to hear. And this is one of the interesting things, that the noise continues to turn up, even though the evidence for what effect this has on dining habits is not conclusive. People, it seems, will often not eat as much in a really loud environment. However, what they will do is drink more. And this was shown in a rigorous study that happened in France last year, where they looked at rate of alcohol consumption directly tied to increasing volumes in the bar. And the louder the noise got, the more drinks people put back in by the minute. So that sense of loss of also of control, of sort of celebratory arousal, is something that some restaurant spaces can benefit from.
You also write in the book how the European Union has mandated measurement of noise and noise controls, which haven't really happened yet, kind of raising the question whether government's ever really going to make a serious impact on at least external noise. The other approach, of course, is soundproofing, that you can try and control your own environment, and there's a going industry there. What's new in the world of soundproofing that you discovered?
Well, what I discovered, if you want to block off your own space from noise and if you have the money, is there are an enormous array of new technologies that you can take advantage of. And again, as long as you have the financial resources, you can make yourself a pretty quiet fortress. There are all sorts of new window treatments that cut sound dramatically. There's something called green glue, which looks a lot like something, if you know the Dr. Seuss book on Bartholomew and the Oobleck, it looks like a big green gooey globby stuff that you can squeeze into just about any crack and it just eats up those sound waves. There are all sorts of quiet concretes. There's quiet steel. There is an amazing explosion of, explosion perhaps not quite the right word, but an amazing proliferation of new technologies to soundproof private space. But what I worry about is that these are not being shared across our society, so that there's no enhancement of our general investment in silence. And these technologies, I think, need for them to have a real resonance in our culture. What we need to do is find ways of sharing them with disadvantaged communities in neighborhoods that are often very, very loud, that don't know about these solutions, and that certainly don't have the means to acquire them.
What were some of the wackier ideas in soundproofing that you came across?
Well, the most radical idea, I think, is this notion of an invisibility cloak that's being worked on, involving these little sonic crystals that they're going to be able to somehow weave together and drape over a small space or over a noise source, and actually it will absorb all sound. In theory, you will be acoustically invisible. I think that's the most extreme example of what's being done.
Well, there was the silence machine. This sounded really wild.
Sorry, yeah, right. There's also a machine that can be programmed to shoot a wave of sound that's exactly counter to the noise source, so that the two cancel each other out. And there actually has been an effort to not only build but to start marketing these silence blasters that you could then, in theory, aim at whatever noise source was torturing you and blast it with a beam that canceled the ability of the wave to reach you.
So it could be an idling bus or your mother-in-law, huh?
Or someone's cell phone, exactly.
So, you know, it seems that you've concluded that government isn't going to get us to shut up. So, what do we do?
Well, one thing I think that we can look towards with great hope is the efforts being made today by some of the creative urban planners working in this field called soundscaping, which really can mean anything that people want. But soundscaping at its best is an effort to perhaps uncover iconic sounds of a neighborhood by stripping away a few layers of noise, diverting traffic from one street, closing up a series of gaps in building walls, maybe reflecting sound from a fountain into a larger area. There are ways that we can create perceptions of silence, even in environments that are not actually quiet. And there are all sorts of interesting interplays here between our senses, so that, for example, it's been found that if you use noise barriers that are aesthetic along a highway, visually aesthetic, that people's perception of the noise level that they're hearing drops by somewhere between 5 and 10 decibels, closer to 10, actually a quite impressive amount. In the same way, it's been discovered that in areas that have fairly large volumes of road traffic noise, if you can find ways to break up that noise at all with natural sounds, birdsong, wind and foliage, maybe some form of falling water, that the perception of the overall noise drops even though those natural sounds actually add to the decibel level. So I felt great excitement about ways that we could work together as a society to build more silent spaces, which would not be just our own little cloistered off fortress of soundproofed fortress, but would be accessible to communities that haven't had experience of silence sometimes for a generation, to any experiences to speak of, and who therefore didn't understand why they should turn down whatever sources of electronic noise they were used to.
And what about refuges? I mean, like community parks, some, you know, places where you can just sit on a bench and just hear the birds.
I think these are essential. And really what I advocate is that we make more of these. You can make parks in extraordinarily small spaces that have extraordinarily large resonance over an urban grid. The experiment that really began in a serious way in New York in the late 1960s with something called pocket parks, where vacant lots were taken over by landscape designers and planted in beautiful ways and set with some kind of a waterfall have proven lasting oases of enormous consequence and enormous value to the city. I think what we really need to do is to find ways of breaking up our experience of incessant noise with things like these small parks that are not a massive financial investment, but that can be so important to people to give them a sense of escape. Even if we live in a loud neighborhood, studies have shown that when there is, for example, a quiet side on the rear of buildings that people feel they can get to without too much effort, the annoyance level of the noise on the front of the buildings drops tremendously. We have now a situation where many, many people feel besieged almost constantly by noise. And I don't think this has to be like this. I think we can work with that problem. We can make more refuges, and they can be modest and still have a real effect. And maybe if we experience enough of these as a society, we'll be stimulated to create more of them, and more people will go off on their own personal pursuits of silence as well.
Well, George Prochnik, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
George Prochnik's book is called In Pursuit of Silence. You can read the first chapter at our website, freshair.npr.org. Today's the 20th anniversary of the first broadcast of Twin Peaks, a groundbreaking TV series that combined murder, drama, and soap opera. Twin Peaks was created by David Lynch and Mark Frost. It still shows up on cable, and there's a definitive gold box set available on DVD. Our critic at large, John Powers, says even after two decades, his heart still skips a beat when he hears Angelo Badalamenti's familiar opening theme.
Back in the summer of 1989, I was invited to a sneak preview of a TV pilot. I didn't know anything about it, but the moment I heard its opening theme music, I got shivers that didn't go away. This was TV the way I dreamed it could be. Funny, menacing, mysterious. In fact, it was so weird and wonderful that as I walked from the theater, I remember saying, "Too bad no network will ever put it on the air." Goes to show what I know. What I'd seen, of course, was the pilot of Twin Peaks. And several months later, ABC did put it on the air, creating an instant sensation. It wasn't simply that the program was a hit, or that Time magazine put Lynch on its cover, dubbing him a genius. Here was a show that had everyone talking the next day about the startling things they'd seen the night before. You know, a spooky reflection of the long-haired killer Bob, or the time that the sexpot Audrey Horne tied a cherry stem into a knot with her tongue. By now, everyone knows the plot. In the small, lumbering town of Twin Peaks, a high school girl, Laura Palmer, is found wrapped in plastic. She's been murdered. Enter Special Agent Dale Cooper, wittily played by Kyle MacLachlan, a chipper FBI man obsessed with coffee, diner food, and Tibetan mysticism. Cooper soon discovers that far from being an amusingly offbeat outpost of innocent Americana, Twin Peaks is a bubbling cauldron of vice. Everybody has secrets, which are uncovered in a fashion that might be called leisurely. Here, Agent Cooper's having breakfast at a cafe when he's joined by the local sheriff, Harry S. Truman, played by Michael Ontkean, and his dim receptionist, Lucy. That's Kimmy Robertson. They think he's going to name the murderer.
Trudy, two more coffees, please. Harry, Lucy, it is an absolutely beautiful morning. Short stack of griddle cakes, melted butter, maple syrup, lightly heated, slice of ham. Nothing beats the taste sensation when maple syrup collides with ham.
Griddle cake, slice of ham.
Who killed Laura Palmer?
Harry, let me tell you about the dream I had last night.
Tibet.
No. You were there. Lucy, so were you. Harry, my dream is a code waiting to be broken. Break the code, solve the crime.
The code, solve the crime.
If you ask Lynch what he cares about most, he'll tell you it's creating a mood you want to be in, Twin Peaks does that with a vengeance, from its dark slated photography to the enveloping score by Angelo Badalamenti. Keeping us off balance, the tone leapfrogs between the silly and the sinister, the comic and the tragic, never more so than in Ray Wise's dazzling performance as Laura's father, Leland Palmer, who's sobbing one moment, breaking into song and dance the next. Twin Peaks smuggled the avant-garde into prime time, brimming with a surrealism you just didn't encounter back then. Remember that weird room with the dwarf who talked backwards? It took cultural stereotypes, the straight-arrow FBI agent, the teen hottie, the wannabe James Dean, the corrupt small-town businessmen, and pushed them until they exploded. The result was an often hilarious show, bursting with raw emotion. For all its brilliance, Twin Peaks did lose its way. The first season was astounding, as were the season 2 episodes that solved Laura Palmer's murder. But the others were pointless, and the world quickly turned against it and Lynch. When he brought out his Twin Peaks movie, Fire Walk With Me, in 1992, it was pilloried, even though after a lousy first 20 minutes, this story about Laura Palmer is one of the most wrenching portraits of teenage life ever filmed. But Lynch has always outlasted those eager to write him off. His 2001 movie, Mulholland Drive, recently won most critics' polls as the best film of the last decade, and Twin Peaks is today recognized as a landmark. His work always feels dreamily timeless, and watching the series now, you're struck by how much has come out of it. For instance, Stephanie Meyer's use of the Pacific Northwest in Twilight. Twin Peaks blazed a trail that led not just to The X-Files and Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but to HBO series like Deadwood and 6 Feet Under. Yet the real importance of Twin Peaks lay not in its direct influence. There's still nothing quite like it on TV. It mattered because, like Dennis Potter's The Singing Detective in Britain, it revealed the untapped possibilities of television. And like all the greatest works of pop culture, it did something more. It broadened public taste. Laura Palmer, Agent Cooper, and the Log Lady didn't merely entertain us. They left the American mainstream a whole lot wider.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue, and his reviews and columns appear on Vogue.com.